This is Audible.
Grio Audio presents an unabridged recording of Everybody Smokes in Hell by John Ridley, narrated by Peter Francis James. This work is copyrighted 1999 by International Famous Players Radio Picture Corporation. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books, producer and publisher of Grio Audio. Author John Ridley began his career as a stand-up comedian in New York, before becoming a writer for television, including such hits as Martin and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He has also worked in film with directors Francis Ford Coppola and Oliver Stone. His directorial debut, Cold Around the Heart, won a Best Director Award at the Urban World Film Festival. This multi-talented author paid a visit to the Recorded Books studio in Manhattan during the audio production of Everybody Smokes in Hell. That interview can be found on the final cassette or disc. John Ridley begins Everybody Smokes in Hell with the following quotation from Raymond Chandler in a letter to Alfred A. Knopf. "The overall picture, as the boys say, is of a degraded community whose idealism even is largely fake. The pretentiousness, the bogus enthusiasm, the constant drinking and drabbing, the incessant squabbling over money, the all-pervasive agent, the strutting of the big shots, and their usually utter incompetence to achieve anything they start out to do, the constant fear of losing all this fairy gold and being the nothing they have never ceased to be, the snide tricks, the whole damn mess is out of this world." January 12th, 1946. And now, Everybody Smokes in Hell.
Hollywood was what the sign said. Said it in giant white letters. Said it big as every dream of every dreamer who ever came tinseltowning. Set it for all the world to see, when anyone could see it at all through the overcoat of smog that kept the city of Los Angeles bundled up tight. Hollywood Land was what the sign used to say. Not anymore. A bunch of decades ago, the land part, having fallen into a state of disrepair, crumbled up and tumbled down the hills, the Hollywood Hills, with all its palatial Hollywood Hills houses. The $3 million, $5 million, as many million dollars as you want to spend houses of the movie stars, and the movie stars' wives, and the movie stars' mistresses, and the movie stars' personal trainers who fucked the mistresses while the movie stars were out making movies about a guy who loves his family. Drop down some more, and you come to Los Feliz, with its smaller, but still kind of big and still very nice houses, that were more for the middle class. If you consider middle class a family that rakes in $250 to $500,000 a year. It was L.A. middle class, anyway. And keep dropping down the hills. Down, down. Like you were taking the express to Purgatory's basement, you hit Hollywood. Dirt, soot, traffic, the homeless. That's what you see without even looking hard. The rest is just Mexicans cruising in their low riders, crackheads passed out in the street, maybe passed out, maybe dead, and an urban rainbow of gang-ready kids. And of course, there was the occasional movie studio. It was night. The movie studios were closed. The cruising Mexicans and the gang kids were in full effect. Hollywood belonged to them. And then there was the white guy. Not just white like you call your average pink flesh guy white. This one was dead pale white. Hold him up to the light and see his kidneys white. Too white for most 20-somethings in a land of beach and sun. Shaggy hair, dirty and tangled like a ball of yarn used to clean floors, hung from his head, obscuring his face. He moved in a hophead dope fiend slow dance, a drug booze mix, his unseen partner, and therefore went just another junkie unnoticed as he swooned and swayed his way across the parking lot, into the 24/7 mart, past the counter. The counter is where the clerk, a black guy sporting an official multicolored 24/7 marked top, rang up an old Russian Jewess who, along with her husband, had survived the massacre at Zagrodzki by the SS Einsatzgruppen to one day come to America, to California, to Silver Lake, where her husband got shanked to death over 15 bucks and change one night when he was walking the dog. The clerk behind the counter didn't know any of this, didn't care, couldn't even pronounce Einsatzgruppen. What he cared about right then was the pair of 13-year-olds trying to snatch a copy of Penthouse from behind the counter. Not particularly because they wanted to see chicks in the buff. They peeped naked chicks on cable for free. But because it was more of a challenge to steal shit from behind the counter than from anywhere else in the store. As he rang up the old Russian woman, who he didn't like because she was always whining about something, not knowing about Zagrodzki or her husband or that she had every reason in the world to whine, because the world had not once ever done anything right by her. He swatted at the two young boys. The clerk swatted at them with his hand and sent them scattering, sent them running past Emilio and Carmen, who were huddled by the dairy case at the back of the 24/7 mart. Emilio had his right hand up Carmen's sweater. Emilio was working her left tit out of her bra. Emilio was getting to some serious fondling like he usually did with Carmen by the dairy case at the back of the 24/7 mart, because that was one of the few places he could fondle Carmen, because Carmen's father hated Emilio, because Carmen's father thought Emilio was a no-good lazy so-and-so whose sole intention was to fuck his daughter. Carmen's father was right. Carmen's father should have kept a better eye on Carmen. Emilio's left hand massaged Carmen's full Mexican ass. Emilio loved Carmen's Mexican ass and whispered with his sexiest voice in Carmen's ear how much he loved her Mexican ass, which really pissed Carmen off, as Carmen's family was from Ecuador. Emilio got his face slapped. Later, him and her would freak in the back of his tricked-out Chevy. But for now, Carmen stormed off, shoving her tit back into her bra as she went, with Emilio begging and pleading right behind. They brushed past Buddy and Alfonso. Buddy and Alf were like a latter-day Abbott and Costello, Buddy being kind of short and kind of dumpy, while Alf was tallish and decent-looking, at least to those who went for the slick-back hair and 5 o'clock shadow look. Most likely the same six people who never missed a rerun of Miami Vice. Alfonso was in the middle of sliding a 40 from the Mart's beer cooler, popping it open and slurping it down. 28 years old, and Alf still got the same schoolboy high from stealing a beer as the 13-year-olds did trying to snatch the Penthouse. Buddy wasn't getting any kicks. Buddy was just nervous. Nervous because Alfonso was stealing the beer. Nervous about what was going down tonight. Nervous because he didn't want to come off as nervous. Buddy was tired of being a nervous guy. He wasn't going to be a nervous guy much longer. Buddy had convinced himself that soon, real soon, courtesy of Alfonso, he was going to be a hard ass. Alfonso finished the beer, moved for the counter. He grabbed up a pack of Twinkies along the way and tossed them down before the clerk, who wore the official multicolor 24/7 marked top and a name tag that read Paris, and who happened to be Buddy's roommate. Not even checking the price, Paris rang up the Twinkies, same as he'd done with tens of dozens of Twinkies and Ho-Hos and Ding Dongs and Slim Jims and Chocodiles and the 30 nights and counting he'd been working at the 24/7 mart. 303, Paris said. For a pack of Twinkies? Alfonso said back. And for the beer you drank. Paris pointed to one of the convex mirrors that hung near the ceiling. Alfonso looked at the mirror, then back at Paris. He got with a smile. The smile said, fuck you. What Alfonso said was, well, ain't you convenience store man? Another couple of years of this, and maybe they'll let you start working during the day. 303. What if I don't got it? His smile went on saying, fuck you. Buddy. Give him the money, Alf. Alfonso just kept staring at Paris, kept smiling at him, kept waiting for him to do something. The something he knew Paris would never do, except stand there while a guy cracked wise at him. Buddy again. Just give him the money. Fucking wimp. Alfonso looked straight ahead, but he could have been talking to either of the roommates, to both of them. Buddy clawed for his wallet. Here, take it. His fingers moved so quick they were barely able to dig free some bills and fumble them to the counter. Just take the money. Fucking wimp. This time for sure was meant for Buddy. Buddy to Alf. We don't need any extra drama, not tonight. Paris to Buddy. Why are you getting messed up with this guy? It was a rhetorical question. Paris knew Buddy well enough to be hep to his aspirations of becoming a hustler and a player, a man who was connected and respected. Like every other nobody in L.A., he wanted to be somebody. The dude Buddy had chosen to apprentice under, Alfonso, was none of the things Buddy wanted to be. But he mimed the banter and faked the rest good enough so that being in Alf's proximity made Buddy feel like he was moving smooth and steady along the road to Macdom. And it's not that Paris much cared what Buddy did or who with, but Alf was such an obvious fuck-up he had to ask his roomie, why are you wasting time with him? How about you just worry about your own shit? Alfonso stepped in to cover for Buddy. Wasn't talking to you. Well, I'm telling you. Alfonso pressed himself up against the counter. It was all that separated him from Paris, and there was nothing but empty air to keep Alfonso from reaching out and giving Paris a great and mighty ass-kicking if he wanted. Paris took a slight but obvious step back. Worry about your own shit, or I'll give you some shit to worry about. Shared stares. Alf's angry. Paris's anxious. Buddy's scared. Eyes flinching around the room. Sweat streaking over his forehead, Buddy was a long way from quitting his nervous guy ways. He inched for the door. Do yourself a favor, Buddy. All this guy is going to bring you is trouble. What are you, his mommy? Alfonso cutting in, not giving up the press. What are you? Nothing but a wannabe hood. Reflexively, Paris flinched in anticipation of the automatic punch to the head that was likely to follow that brand of smart mouth. But the remark didn't so much bother Alfonso as give him something else to fuck you smile about. Oh yeah, he said. I'm nothing. Why don't you say that again while you're ringing up a big guzzle? I'm nothing. And you're nothing but a loser. For a real quick second, a picture flashed in Paris's mind. A picture of her screaming those same words at him. The memory of it, a bitter sting like a bad scar that won't fade away. Shut up, Paris yelled back. How's the world look from across that counter? Better get used to the view. Get out of here! Alfonso got out. He took all the slow groove time he wanted doing it. Buddy tagged along behind. Paris was left standing right where he was, kept close company by the shame of so readily accepting the humiliation he'd been handed. A beat later, the filthy white guy took up the space at the counter Alfonso had previously filled, his arms brimming with frozen burritos. Frozen burritos were a popular item with late-night hopheads. The filthy white guy opened his arms and the burritos thudded on the counter, cinder block heavy. Without putting thought to it, Paris scanned the burritos as he'd done with tens of dozens of frozen burritos and frozen pizzas and frozen burgers and frozen chili dogs he'd rung up in the 30 nights and counting he'd been working at the 24/7 Mart. 30 nights. 1 month. Happy anniversary, Paris. Paris said, $8. Filthy white guy dug gangly hands in his pockets. Pale fingers pulled out a bill. $100 bill. Filthy white guy just held it up for Paris like it was nothing but ordinary for a filthy white guy to come around a 24/7 Mart in the middle of the night buying frozen burritos with $100 bill. Paris took the bill and looked it over careful, as if he would know a fake one when he saw it. After going through the motion of giving Ben Franklin all the attention he felt he deserved to filthy white guy. Welfare been good to you, huh? I always knew even poor white guys was rich. Barely, Paris made change, gave it back to filthy white guy. Filthy white guy jammed the fistful of bills in his pocket with all the care of someone who'd gotten back used Kleenex for their cash. Scooping up the burritos, filthy white guy carried them, dropping a few along the way, they bounced off the linoleum, over to the complimentary 24/7 Mart microwave, and put them, all of them, inside. Paris, who had watched this one man just say no campaign, came around the counter. Come on, one at a time. It was just then, the 2 13-year-olds who had been laying in wait for the perfect op, reached over the counter and grabbed the penthouse they'd been eyeing all night. Hey! Paris moved for the kids. Filthy white guy turned on the microwave. The overstuffed machine groaned and flashed and popped and spewed radiated burritos all over the store. The kids made it out the door. Everywhere, burrito parts dripped and slid and oozed in downward patterns. Paris caught a glimpse of himself in one of the Mart security mirrors. His body, draped in the multicolored uniform, distorted by the curve of the glass, made him look very much like a pathetic circus clown. I can't deal with this, the clown muttered. I can't deal with it. Mr. Bashir was a very understanding guy. It is the type of decision a manager is faced with every day, he said. He said what he said even in tone, reassuring, despite having lost a microwave oven. Paris couldn't recall having ever seen Mr. Bashir pissed. It must be, he figured, because Mr. Bashir was from the Middle East, or the East, or from one of those terrorist-filled, war-torn countries over there. And once you got the hell out of over there, alive, any other kind of shit life threw at you was nothing but a foot massage. Bashir went on. The magazine or the microwave? You tried to stop the children from reading, and meanwhile my microwave is burned up like my wife's tandoori chicken. Could you ever sound real pissed, Paris wondered, with that kind of sing-songy accent anyway? Come on, even if you were screaming to beat the devil, everything out of your mouth would come off like you were yapping on helium. I'm sorry, I only turned around for a second and... Life is learning. And what you have learned is that if little boys want to give themselves erections, then so be it, but save the microwave. I'm sorry. Tomorrow is a whole new day. And with it come whole new opportunities. Next time, you will do better. Kind words from Mr. Bashir. Tomorrow. Next time. Tomorrow. Next time. Kind words that were like a slap in the face. How many tomorrows did Paris have to look forward to as night boy at the 24/7 Mart? 30 down, a lifetime to go? Yeah, I'll see you tomorrow, Mr. Bashir. Outside, the parking lot, Paris walked to his car, a 1976 AMC Gremlin. It was a bad knockoff of the Ford Pinto, which itself was as awful a piece of mechanical engineering all the great brains in Detroit had ever devised and could still get away with selling to the public. Rusted holes you could jam a fist through. Peeling green paint fell away like flakes of snow. Just in case the car had some value, those kept it from having any. And something new. Filthy white guy, on the ground, propped up against the driver's door. This, Paris most definitely did not need. Aw, come on! Hey! His foot poked and nudged at filthy white guy. No way he was going to touch that shit with his hand. Hey, hey! You're sleeping on my car! Come on, man, move! He did. Filthy white guy responded to the foot nudges by sliding along the side of the car until his head smacked the ground. You okay? You sick of something? Sick of something, Paris thought. Try high or something. Hopped up or something. Crack, blow, smacked up or something. Paris, forgetting his feet, shoving the guy now with his bare hands. Move it, okay, pal? Time to stroll back to Bumville. Filthy white guy, lips barely moving, voice little more than a whisper. I want to go home. You and me both. So you want to slide over? Filthy white guy gave Paris just enough room to squeeze into his car, just enough room to back the gremlin out without crushing the white guy's skull under the tires. Paris fired up the engine and was ready to do just that. Back out, head off, go home. But he didn't. What he did was look around the parking lot, around the Hollywood surrounding it. Dark, empty. Empty except for punks who looked like bangers and addicts who looked like killers. And here was filthy white guy, one half passed out and, as Paris recalled, pockets swollen with cash. He was no better than bleeding brill waiting for sharks to pick up the scent. Rolling down the window, Paris leaned out of the car. You can't stay around here, man. Someone's gonna roll you. Over the sputtering gremlin engine, Paris heard, I wanna go home. More looking around the parking lot. Still just as dark and deserted, except for the bangers and the addicts, only... And maybe this was Paris's own paranoia. The bangers and the addicts seemed to have circled in closer, waiting for Paris to split the scene, waiting for him to leave filthy, half-passed-out white guy all to them. Engine off. Paris wasn't a particularly good person, and that was by his own figuring. It's not like he hung around soup kitchens doling out freebies or gave a damn when dykes were outside Mayfair Market in WeHo collecting money for the AIDS walk. But he was one of those there-but-for-the-grace-of-God guys. One of those guys that thought, if you went out of your way to ignore someone else's bad shit, then that same bad shit was liable to boomerang around and smack you in the head at some point. So from time to time, Paris found himself doing things that weren't really in his heart, but were just a way, like a gambler's ritual, of keeping more trouble from his already troubled existence. This was one of those times. Paris knew the feeling, the need to slot himself some good karma, and frankly, the feeling didn't feel good. Damn it! Out of the gremlin. Grabbing filthy white guy under the arms, Paris dragged him toward the passenger side. And you better not have AIDS or some shit. AIDS. Paris thought, maybe he should have been nicer when the dykes were out collecting. You fucking stink, Paris ranted. This is craziness, Paris thought. But he engaged in the craziness anyway, by driving Sunset after he asked Filthy White Guy where he lived, and Filthy White Guy replied with a limp finger pointing westward, and nothing more. So Paris headed the gremlin westward. Filthy white guy draped the seat next to him in a semi-limp, semi-conscious way as he produced an odor that was a museum-quality collection of puke, piss, funk, and general body reek.
"Fucking stink!"
Paris ranted on. Filthy white guy responded to that by letting his head thud against the glass of the window.
"I'm not going to get that smell out. And don't tell me about driving around with the windows open. Drive around with the windows open all you want. It's the kind of smell that don't go away. Ever."
Between rants, Paris had begun to notice something, vaguely, as he wasn't always quick with his observations. He had driven west like Filthy white guy had finger-pointed him to, and they had gone from the scummy part of Hollywood across La Brea to the kind of nice part of Hollywood on past Crescent Heights, Laurel Canyon, to the nice part of West Hollywood, way past Ahoney to the very ultra-beautifully nice part of Beverly Hills. So intent was Paris on the gremlin's new aromas and what he was going to do about them, he hadn't paid much mind to his driving.
"Where are we going, man? I'm not taking you all the way out to Santa Monica. You even got a place, or you just..."
"Here's a thought," thought Paris. "What if Filthy white guy isn't as messed up as he seems? What if he was faking his days to get a ride with some too nice guy dumb enough to drive him and drive him until they were somewhere quiet, secluded, like Will Rogers Park, where has-been pop stars went to jerk themselves, and where a filthy white guy could do all manner of unpleasant things to a guy who's been real nice, and there wouldn't be anyone around to know about it?" Here's another thought, thought Paris. Aren't most serial killers filthy white guys?
"Here."
The word, coming loud and unexpectedly as it did from Filthy white guy, made Paris jerk the wheel, pulling the gremlin into oncoming traffic. A blaring horn and flashing lights from a speeding Jag. Paris jammed on the brakes while he screamed,
"Don't you touch me! Don't you fuck...
Here, turn here!" Paris looked off to his right, where Filthy white guy wanted him to turn. A spot Paris had passed how many dozen times but had never turned off into, because he never had any reason before, and would never have figured if he did have a reason, it would be to take some bum home. It was a street called Bellagio. It was the west gates of Bel Air.
"You live here?"
Weak, tired, but with no hint of acknowledging the oddness Paris found in a homeless guy wanting to get taken to some of the slickest pads in town.
"Yeah."
Paris sat in traffic for a second, Benzes and Beamers honking away as they had to drive around him. He was way skeptical about what Filthy white guy was asking, but eventually got to where he what-the-helled himself. He traveled this far down the road. Why not take it just a little further? His voice shrugged.
"I guess if you've got to be a bum, might as well be a bum in the best part of town."
The gremlin signaled right and went into Bel Air. Paris drove up Bellagio and up Chalon and all the way up Roscommere and kept going up until they were just barely south of Mulholland, barely south of the top of Los Angeles, where Filthy white guy pointed Paris toward a pair of huge iron gates that secured a long driveway which disappeared into a thicket of trees. For Paris, the joke had run its course. Filthy white guy? Living in there? No, no way. Except, Filthy white guy hopped out of the gremlin and tap-tapped a couple of numbers on a keypad. The gates slowly opened, as if backing away from his presence. Filthy white guy got back in the car. Paris, near astonished.
"Okay, so what's the punchline?"
"None. It's mine."
Filthy white guy was making a nice recovery from his intoxication. The kind of recovery that comes from being very used to recovering from being intoxicated on a regular basis.
"Your parents rich or something?"
Now it was Filthy White Guy who was astonished, but in a very amused way.
You have no idea who I am.
From looking around, I'd say you're the Pope of Skid Row. Filthy White Guy smiled, but he didn't laugh. Not that he didn't want to. It was more like he didn't have any laughter in him. Paris drove through the huge gates toward what else but a huge house. It was a big stone English countryside-looking thing. What style, Paris didn't know, other than it being the biggest house he'd ever seen. Seen up close, anyway. It wasn't just the house that was impressive, but the yard as well. Yard, acre, meadow, lush, emerald grass, trees, a pond. All that not even done yet. Landscaping equipment, shrubs with their roots wrapped, bags of fertilizer. How much more perfect, Paris wondered, could you make a piece of land? Around a drive to the mansion's front door. Did mansions have anything as blah as a front door? Or did they have a west door, a receiving door, a main reception area off the garden? Whatever it was, whatever it was called, Filthy White Guy got out of the car, opened it, and went into the house. Not a word to Paris. Just out and in. The door stayed open. Just a crack. Just a hint. Open and inviting. A casual flirtation, same as the smile and glance from a passing woman. A silent proposition to the curious, waiting to be acted upon. So Paris had choices. He could turn the gremlin around, drive away, know nothing more about what happened this evening than what happened. He had given a ride to a drunk Hollywood vagrant who wasn't quite that, but more like a drunk Bel Air vagrant who wasn't vagrant at all. Paris could turn, drive away, leaving all this for what it seemed to be. More of the craziness that passed as commonplace, everyday L.A. Or, the door was still open. The flirtation was ongoing. Paris turned the key. After running on a bit, the gremlin's engine sputtered out. He followed Filthy White Guy into the house. Inside. Huge, of course, and lots more styles and designs Paris didn't particularly know, but had seen in period movies he'd watched while working those couple of weeks in that video store. African crap and Indian-looking stuff, and some junk he thought he remembered from a Kurosawa film. And not separated or grouped, all the styles were blended up and mixed together to form a thing all its own. It was a... what was it? It was a mosaic woven of the world. A tapestry held in private. A museum for one. Like in Citizen Kane, Paris recalled. That Kane guy had a private museum. That Kane guy was also a lonely, miserable wreck. Paris wandered around looking for Filthy White Guy. He wandered into and out of room after room after room. A room filled with books. A room with a pool table. A room with a pool. Finally, in a room with a big leather couch and a bar, just a couch and a bar, Paris found Filthy White Guy. No preamble. Want something to drink? Yeah, sure. From the bar, Filthy White Guy grabbed up two bottles of Dewar's, one for Paris and one for himself. He grabbed them up no different than if he were grabbing up a couple of beers. Paris spun the top and took a sip. Filthy White Guy gave himself a long and healthy swig. To him, it was a bottle of beer. Paris said, "You were surprised I didn't know who you are, like I should."
"Yeah, you should."
"So who are you?"
Again from Filthy White Guy, the amused look. A look that was almost grateful, as if anonymity was a new and good sensation, a first kiss. He walked to a pair of double doors, stopped, looked back at Paris, and gave that humorless smile one more time. A hesitation, a dramatic pause that asked, "Ready?" From Paris, the silent question got a nod. Filthy white guy pushed the doors open. Inside the room, the four walls, floor to ceiling, the shelves and bookcases, every inch of space was covered, filled, crammed and overflowing with statues, awards, plaques, certificates, trophies, gold records, platinum records, multi-platinum records, Grammys, American Music Awards, Billboard Awards, radio plays, certifications, awards to the point awards didn't mean anything anymore and were no longer hung on the wall or carefully placed in some semblance of order on a shelf, but were just put in this corner or that. Not even put. Thrown. And not thrown very well. Paris stepped to one of the framed RIAA multi-million sales awards, one that was obviously received early on enough that it got a spot of honor on a wall. Reading from it. "Will of Instinct. You in that band?" "I'm the lead singer." Paris blank stared him. "Ian Germain." More blank stare. "You've never seen me on MTV?" "Don't know, I guess. Grungy white guys all kind of look alike to me. That alternative shit sort of played out anyway. No offense." Indignant. "And what kind of shit do you listen to, rap?" Indignant right back. "No, I don't listen to rap. What, I'm black, I gotta like rap?" Paris headed into the other room, the room with the couch and the bar, taking more than a few hits of Doers on the way. "And if you're such a big-ass rock star," he got back on the offensive, "how come you're crawling around Hollywood at 3 a.m? "I was out celebrating, got a little wasted." Ian was behind the bar. Another bottle got opened. "It's my birthday." "Happy birthday." "What's so happy about it?" "I'm turning 25. "So?" "So?" "Yeah, so you're 25. So what?" Ian found Paris's naivete blatantly entertaining, the way that wheelchair science guy would find a man who couldn't add, "Here fucking hilarious." "You know, when you hit 25, you're closer to 50 than you are to the day you were born." Never having given an idea like that much thought, Paris just shrugged. "Closer to 50. Ian underscored his words as if syllabic emphasis would make his point clear. "I'm rolling on 50. "Sure, you practically feeble. Maybe you ought to trade in this joint for a room at the home." Paris was giving a pass at sarcasm, but Ian just went with the idea. "Not a rest home, somewhere else."
"Where?"
"Someplace wonderful."
"Vegas?"
"Ever heard of this dude, Yokio Mishima?" Ian knew that Paris hadn't, so he didn't bother waiting for an answer. "He was a Japanese author. Temple of the Golden Pavilion. Sea of Fertility Tetralogy. You should read him sometime."
"Read much?"
Ian knew that Paris didn't, so he didn't bother waiting for an answer. "So Mishima, right? He thought the problem with the world was that people let themselves get all old and decrepit and shit. He thought that back in ancient Greece, heaven must have been flossing because everybody kicked real young. Dig?" Paris followed, but he wasn't sure what he was following. "Die young, stay pretty, that kind of thing." Ian put the doers down. He drank some first, then put it down, and crossed the room to a katana that hung on the wall. Paris didn't know it was a katana. All Paris knew was that it was one of them Japanese-looking swords like the one in the dojo he worked out in back when he was trying to become the next Jet Li. Jet Li must have worked out like a bastard, because Paris went at it twice a week for almost 4.5 weeks and never got any better. Ian took the katana from its mounting, unsheathed it from a lacquered scabbard. The tempered steel blade was accented with a 24-karat gold electroplate, the handle covered with an elaborate blood-red braiding. For an instrument of death, it was a beautiful thing. Light hit the blade, polished up like a mirror, and reflected with a near-blinding brilliance. Slowly, gracefully, Ian did battle with the empty air. As he slashed his phantom opponent, he had a philosophy, Mishima, art and action. The completion of a great work of arts gotta be followed by a great physical action. Then the two are forever joined by ritual suicide. Death at your greatest moment. First you become immortal, then you die. Like you write a really good song and then do that knife in the stomach thing? Ian did a disappointed head shake. Paris's ignorance was killing him. Katana back in the sheath, back up on the wall. Ian. Ain't simple like all that, you know? Nothing easy about death. You gotta go strong. You gotta go memorable. Marilyn and Jimmy Dean. Any motherfucker can live. Only legends die good. And that's what you're planning to do? You turn 25 and you're gonna check out big time? Ian's answer was another pull at the doer's bottle. Paris matched it with a sip of his own. Yeah, well, I've heard that alternative shit, and it sure as hell ain't worth dying over. With his chin, Ian pointed. Over there, across the room on a table, a dat player. Small, like a pack of smokes, maybe a little bigger. Headphones hooked up. Paris looked at the player, back to Ian, who again did the chin point, then crossed the room. Headphones snug over his ears, a finger to a button, play. Music. Paris listened. Eventually the tape ran to its end. The player cut off. Paris lifted the headphones. To Ian, one word, the only word, that expressed everything he just heard simply and completely. Wow. Wow, he said again. I recorded that myself. You and your band? No. I've got a studio in the house. That right there is all me. Known adjective seemed meaningless to Paris, inadequate and a feeble form of description. Wow. My last will and testament. Forget about alternative or grunge or being so cutting edge you got no edge at all. That right there is something pure and special and right on. That is magic most holy. That is art most phenomenal. That is what I'm leaving this thinking world. All that remains is the action. Maximum evolution, dude. I'm taking my shit to the other level. Ian preached like a surfer Dalai Lama. He preached on. Death is life. The bigger I die, the larger I live. And I'm about to blow up Chuate more than anybody ever knew how. You see how powerful I just came? A couple of nods from Paris. Yeah, I get it.
You're a spoiled rich white kid who pays for his burritos with $100 bills, thinks he's the next James Dean, and wants to off himself because he's turning 25 and nobody sang him happy birthday loud enough.
Same as a big fat fuck you, Ian took Paris's words. Same as a slap to the face. He moved at Paris, Paris just then thinking it might not have been a good idea to wise talk a drunk rock guy, as drunk rock guys were unpredictable. Sometimes they trashed hotel rooms. Sometimes they beat the shit out of their supermodel girlfriends. Sometimes they just wrote a new song that sold a couple million copies, but usually it was one of the first two. But Paris realized his mistake after he'd said what he'd said, so the thought was punctured condom useless.
As if someone like you could ever dig where I'm at. Ian's hand shot out to Paris.
Paris flinched, but all Ian did was grab at that little plastic name tag Paris wore, rip it from his orange and green and smoothie-stained uniform, and flick it back at him so that it thwapped against his face with a mild sting. Injury to the insult. A guy who wears a name tag to work and rings up Doritos and Yoo-hoos for a living. How the hell could you understand? You're nothing but a loser.
That picture flashed up in front of Paris again. The picture of her. And with picture came sound.
You're a loser.
Sharp, hot, Paris screamed back.
I'm not a loser.
Ian turned away. Not pushed away by the force of Paris's words, but simply turned away like a guy who couldn't stand the sight of what he was looking at anymore. With his back to Paris.
What are you then, huh? You know what I've done in my time? I've stood before the multitudes and sung my heart as they chanted my very words back to me. I've made love to the most beautiful women to walk this earth. As the sun rose and set, then rose again. I've been a poet, a voice of my generation, a living legend. And then I turned 25. What have you ever done, dude? And you rap to me about a wasted life? I may die, but you, brother, you ain't never even lived.
Collapsing on the big leather couch, Ian curled up with the doers. A booze teddy bear.
The time of my departure has come. I have fought a good fight, kept the faith. I have finished the race. That's God talking. Thanks for the ride, friend. Maybe it's time you took one yourself.
With that, like a TV with its cord yanked, Ian faded and shut off. Paris just stood, immobile, held in place by the singer's pointed words and feeling his every wound. Eventually he collected his freshly slapped around self and slow limped for the door that would lead to the long hall he would walk to his car that would drive him back to a wasted life. Halfway there, a soft call halted him, turned him. It wasn't a voice that beckoned. It was a feeling. On the table, the DAT player, the music. The same feeling that had turned Paris around now articulated ideas. Take a ride, the feeling said. Eyes to Ian, passed out. Eyes to the player, the music. Eyes to the next room. All those multi-platinum, multi-million selling awards. The feeling said, take a chance. And then the player was in his hand. Paris couldn't even recall his actions or any philosophical debate over right and wrong, should or shouldn't. There was just the player, suddenly, in his grip. And even as he contemplated the rapidity with which the act of stealing had taken place, the act had itself become a relic of the distant past. Already he was outside the house. Already he was yanking open the gremlin's door and throwing himself behind the wheel. Already he was speeding away from the home of the artist formerly known as Filthy White Guy back to Hollywood. Para stopped trying to play catch-up with his actions and just let them happen. Just rode a wave of occurrences. By the time his body and mind were back in sync, the gremlin had parked itself outside his apartment. Para sat, the car's motor coughing itself out, looking down at his hand. He hard stared at the DAT machine. But it was to Ian he said, and to her, "I'm not a loser." Buddy drove a Continental, big, old, a 63, same as the one Kennedy got his head opened up in. Buddy had bought it on the cheap off a girl doing a quick sell for some get-me-to-Canada money. He didn't ask questions when they swapped cash for car. Even though the Continental was probably stolen, or involved in a crime, or had some such history riding with it, Buddy didn't ask nothing. He didn't care. He just liked the car. That was Buddy's problem. One of them. He didn't ask questions. His other problem, another of them, was that he usually paid for his ignorance by getting undertowed into some bad incident he could have avoided if he'd made a few inquiries up front. He thought about that, Buddy did, his two problems, two of his problems, as he angled the Continental across from a Watts tenement. "You ready?" Alf asked, meaning, "You ready to commit a felony? You ready to mix it up with other criminals? You ready to get dangerous?" "Sure," was Buddy's answer. One word, and it stumbled its way out of his mouth, tripping over fear and jitters. Was he ready? Hell no. But he was going to fake readiness as much as the next "I never stole anything in my life" guy who wants to be a player. But Alf was all right with the answer. "Yeah, see, I knew you was cool." "I'm cool." "Not like that roomie of yours. That boy's straight bitch," Alf said, trying to talk like a brother, which is the way white guys talked when they wanted to sound cool. Didn't work, not for him, not for any white guy. "He ain't nothing, and ain't never gonna be nothing but nothing. Working for minimum at a goddamn juice stand. He better ask somebody. Shit don't get handed to you." "I know." "You want something, you gotta reach for it." "Yeah, yeah, I know." "Reach out and make it your own." "I know, yeah." "Uh-huh. I knew you was cool." "I'm cool." Buddy paused then. "I just..." "What?" "I just..." Alf looked all disappointed. "You ain't gonna punk, are you?" "No, I..." "Last minute and you decide to go punk?" "I'm not a punk." Buddy jacked up his tone and volume, trying to approximate manliness, and got fairly close with the effort. "I just want to make sure everything is... I got things worked, all right? I got things figured." Looking over at the tenement. "He's nothing but a doped-up addict who deals on the side, small time, but enough to start us on Easy Street. I go in, take what I want, we're gone. That's simple. So save the punk act." "Simple. Yeah." "I'm not... just making sure." Alfonso got himself out of the car. His hand dipped under his jacket. He came back out, gripping a gun. Buddy had to work overtime not to wet himself. Hardasses didn't piss their pants at the sight of heat. To Alf, fronting like a man of action. "Let's get it on." Alfonso, yeah, baby, smiled to that. He wasn't smiling on the inside. On the inside, Alfonso was worn out. Because on the inside, Alf knew Buddy was a bitch, and it took a lot of effort to pretend he wasn't. Too much effort, he thought, just to jack heroin. It ain't worth it. He should have had his own wheels. If he had his own wheels, he wouldn't need Buddy and his traveling girly show. Alf marked that top of list of things to do with his H money. Get wheels. Dump the bitch. Alfonso crossed for the tenement. Buddy sat in the car, working out his fear and kind of beaming to himself. He did it. He wasn't a punk. He was a man. He was there, wasn't he? Wasn't he backing Alf up? Even though he was just sitting in a car with the motor running across the street from the action, wasn't he doing what he was supposed to be doing? Punk? Nah, he wasn't no punk. Buddy spun some thoughts on that, on his new self-approved non-punk status, while he shaky-handed a cigarette to his lips, then managed to fumble on the car lighter, waited for it to pop out, and lit up his smoke. Meanwhile, time didn't move. It just sat on its ass, doing nothing, when what it should have been doing was passing, racing along, so Alf would come strolling out the door of the tenement, smile on face and smack in hand. A brick of it. A kilo. Isn't that what Alf had said? Buddy didn't know drugs. He didn't know the metric system. But he knew enough to know that a kilo of heroin was a heap. Cut that shit up, mix it with some baby powder or baking soda, sell it on the street, and it was worth... Well, it was worth a lot. Alf had said it was, so it must have been. And there was a whole gang of things Buddy could do with that kind of money. There were plans he had. There were a lot of things he was gonna do. Buy some junks, for one. Go out, buy shit, and not even look at the price tag while he was doing it. And chicks. There would be chicks. Where money is concerned, chicks aren't far behind. And with the chicks would come the sex. Abundant fucking, inspired by the shine of gold and the glitter of diamond. Precious metal and stone pressed to flesh. That was the only foreplay a good woman needed. Yeah, Buddy was going to be a man with money. And don't nobody not respect a money man. Time had apparently died, because it still wasn't moving. It lay like a corpse. That, or Buddy had just sucked down his cig in two draws. Either way, he needed another smoke. One got fished out from the pack and put to his lips. He pushed in the lighter. When it got hot enough, it popped back out. Buddy, the lighter. He lifted it to the cigarette in his mouth. Just as the coil touched the paper, as the heat lit the tobacco, that's when time came alive. And with great rapidity, shit began to happen. All manner of shit. Across the street, the tenement windows got lit with muzzle flashes. The building echoed with pops. Loud pops. Loud enough to jump the lighter from Buddy's hand. Loud enough to make his heart triple pump. Loud enough to make his body shake and his bladder want to spill. Shit! Came squealing out of him. Oh, shit! Forget all the tough guy, big man talk he'd been slinging. Buddy was on the non-stop to Bitchville. All he was missing was a pretty dress and fuzzy pink slippers. Buddy had the desire to move, to duck and hide, or better idea, to put foot to gas and get the hell gone. But he didn't. He didn't move. Fear was a concrete overcoat that held him right where he was. All he could do was what he had done before, so he did it again.
Shit!
Tenement door. Alfonso came sleepwalking out. Buddy shrugged off the fear just long enough to get from the car, go to Alf, prop him up. All that was reflex. If Buddy had put a second's thought to what he was doing, put a thought to the fact that the muzzle flashes he'd seen and pops he'd heard could come again, and this time come for him, he would have been curled up on the floor mats of the Continental weeping.
Alf, Alfonso, what happened?
Alfonso mumbled.
What the hell happened?
The mumbles turned into words.
They shouldn't have been there. What? What are you... Those motherfu... Shouldn't have...
Buddy walked dragged Alfonso to the car... to the back seat, threw him in. Moving quick to the front, Buddy got himself behind the wheel. The dash lights lit his hands. They were soaked with a liquidy redness that dripped and ran down his forearms. Buddy looked to Alf. Blood gurgled from a bunch of holes in his body. Panic.
Oh, Jesus! You're... Oh, shit!
Faint from the back seat.
Dry. I... Oh, shit! Oh, fucking sh... Drive.
Drive? All Buddy was good for was sitting and shaking.
I... Fuck! I can't deal with this shit!
A breakdown was coming. It was coming fast. It was coming hard.
I can't deal with it! You gotta drive. You gotta...
Drive. Buddy focused up on the word. It planed the edge off his panic, gave him something besides shot up people and flowing blood to concentrate on. Drive. Yeah, he had to drive. Hand to the key, a twist. He ground the motor that was already running. Jerking the gear shift up and down the PRNDL, Buddy finally found the D slot. Heavy footing the gas, the tires screamed, rubber on asphalt. The Continental got itself on into the night, fishtailing wide and wildly as it went. From the back seat, barely.
Shouldn't have been there. No shit, we shouldn't have been there. What the hell were we? They shouldn't have been. They? Who? They shouldn't have. Who was there? Who?
Hard turn. Buddy's hand slipped over the steering wheel. The mix of blood and sweat stole his grip. The Continental's front tire kicked up over the curb. The fender clipped a light pole. Metal ground metal and threw up a jizz of sparks.
I got it.
Blood filled Alf's lungs. He sounded like he was slowly slipping underwater.
Don't think I didn't get it. Got them too. Bitches.
Some coughs. Alf slipping further under. Inches from the deep end of forever. Billboards of circumstance whipped past Buddy. Signs advertising events and eventualities. Alfonso in the backseat bleeding would lead to Alfonso in the backseat dying, which would result in Buddy having to get rid of a dead Alfonso. Panic into anger.
Don't you die on me!
Buddy didn't care so much about Alf as he cared about being stuck with Alf's body.
Don't you fucking die on me! Goddamn. Fuh. No, you don't. You don't die.
The Continental rode on, furiously, with no destination in mind. Buddy went on admonishing Alf, despite the collection of 5 bullets he carried in him, for having the audacity to slowly, painfully, horribly, bleed to death. To the east, the sun was getting with the sky. It lit up the empty blue, set on fire the morning smog like a match to kindling, and turned the pollutant shroud a magnificent gold. So magnificent you almost wanted to thank God for all the millions of cars that had donated their exhaust to make the display possible. Ian faced east, faced the sun. He felt the first of its warmth creeping across his flesh. He felt calm and relaxed. He felt serene. He felt the barrel of a shotgun butt up against his chin. He settled on a shotgun suicide, Ian had, because he thought it ironic. His brain, his organ of creation, after giving birth to the most magnificent piece of music that mankind would ever attend, was to be scattered in a fine puree that would seed the garden beneath the very balcony where he stood. From that moment on, the flowers that grew, the life that pushed its way up from the ground, would bear his essence. Then in the crowning achievement of the most perfect self-inflicted death, by acts of nature, the pollination and cross-pollination of countless plants, Ian would be reborn 10 times 10,000 times throughout the world. The image of the end he had planned was a very beautiful thought. He rushed through thinking about it because Ian didn't have time to think beautiful things. He was way behind in a schedule that called for him to splatter his brains at dawn. The booze had kept him sleeping late. The sun was already pushing up past the horizon. No chance to change clothes, hook up some cooler gear to be found no longer living in. No time to write a suicide note. The music would serve as goodbye. The music on the tape and the player on the table where he'd left it last night. Where he was pretty sure he had left it last night. Last night. All the drink had taken an eraser to his short-term memory. The sun going from warm to hot. It didn't just light the smog now. The sun cooked it. Turned the atmosphere into a noxious gas that would slow-choke Los Angeles and all its air-kissing troglodytes for the next 12 hours. Now was the time. Ian's finger gripped the trigger of the shotgun. The time to evolve to the next level, to a higher plane. A slow, steady pull. Art, action, and ritual death. The sound of the hammer scraping back against its casing. The door was opening. Ian was stepping into immortality. The click of the trigger. The snap of the hammer. The sound of firing pin hitting a shell. There was nothing. Not a thing. Misfire. The shotgun didn't go off. How about that, Ian thought. He started up again. Again he pulled the trigger. Evolution to the next level. Art, action, ritual death, immortality. Click, snap, hammered a shell.